Whole Foods Market has savings to power your day during the Kickstart the Season event. Take advantage of a huge sale on all supplements, like vitamins, protein powders, probiotics, and more. There's a sale on all packaged coffee to get you back in the groove. Plus, find wallet-happy prices on breakfast like organic eggs and bacon from $3.65 by Whole Foods Market. And when the week gets busy, bring home a family meal and let the pros do the cooking. Kickstart fall at Whole Foods Market. Terms apply.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, unlicensed lunch therapist, Adam Roberts. My patient today is Rosie Schapp. She's a former bartender and drink columnist for the New York Times, and she's the author of several books, including Drinking with Men and Becoming a Sommelier. In today's episode, Rosie talks all about being Jewish in Northern Ireland.
You know, I call myself the Jewess of the Glens because I think I might be the only one, at least in the district where I live.
What she looks for in a bartender.
I really, really resent the kind of bartender who wants to get people shit-faced.
And what a peanut vendor told her friend at her dad's memorial service.
Almost no one who bought peanuts from me asked me what my name was. And Dick did, and he always remembered it and always looked for me, and that's why I'm here at his memorial service.
All right, without further ado, here is my session with Rosie Schapp.
Well, Rosie, I am so glad to meet you. We were just pre-chatting before this started, and I guess we met way back when you had a reading on the Lower East Side in New York. Is that right?
That is right. I ran a reading series at a Swedish bar and restaurant called Good World. It was a great place. And every month we had a theme, and I did a couple of food writer readings. If I remember correctly, you were in the first with Slow Foods, Patrick Martins. And I think, there was someone else. Andrea Strong.
Yes, 100%. Yes. Andrea Strong.
I have such a great selective memory.
Is Andrea Strong still writing about food? Because I used to follow her all the time in New York.
You know, I think she slowed down for a while, but is still out there. I haven't been in touch with her in a while. We met at Good World when we were both young, fresh New Yorkers.
We're still young, fresh something. I don't know if we're New Yorkers. I'm about to be a New Yorker again, but...
Right. I'm excited.
When did you say you're in Ireland, right? I mean, I wanted to just maybe get out of the gate and ask you, how did and why did this all come about?
Well, that's a good question, Adam. I've had a long romance with Ireland in all the way back in 1991. I did my study abroad at Trinity College in Dublin and, you know, made friends pretty easily and have stayed good friends with many of the Dubliners I met that summer. And back then, Northern Ireland, which is where I live, was still in the midst of what's known as the Troubles, the 30 years of deadly conflict up here in the north. And we international students at Trinity were basically told, don't go up there. There's nothing to see, which I think was just their way of avoiding us getting, you know, harmed or something. But, you know, like any self-respecting 20-year-old, I did exactly as I was told not to do. And just spent one night. And it was a tense time up north, and that was just Belfast. I didn't have time to explore any of the countryside. Decades passed, and I'd been back to the Republic of Ireland many times, but I hadn't been back to the north since 1991. And a travel writer friend said, you haven't been up north since the peace process started, you should go. It's a very different place. They're really thrilled to have people coming back just to be on holiday, not to be reporting on war. And my friend was right. I enjoyed my time here in 2010 so much that I kept pitching stories that would bring me back. And in 2016, I was doing a story for the New York Times travel section, not far from where I live now. And I know myself. So after I finished my reporting, I looked for a little place where I could hide away and write for a few days, because I knew if I didn't at least start writing the story before getting back on a plane, I would be in trouble. I know how I work. I'm a procrastinator. And the only place that met all of my criteria, I wanted to be by the sea. I wanted to be able to walk to a pub. was a village called Glen Arm, a place available, and I just fell really hard for it and thought, next year I'll try to come back for a month. So the next year, 2017, I did that. And in 2019, after a lot of thinking about a book that would deeply involve Northern Ireland, I moved over. I thought it would be for a year. But then COVID happened. And
right.
Then
I always
married.
Forget that when people tell their stories. I'm like, oh, yeah, COVID. I forgot about
right,
that.
Right, right. I thought it would be a year. And then I got married and got a dog, and I'm still here.
Wow. So, okay.
Yeah.
And so did you meet your partner in Northern Ireland?
I did, but this is the funny thing. When I tell this story to people, they think it was like a COVID romance, you know, some kind of Stockholm syndrome lockdown together. We've just met. We actually met on that first trip back to Northern Ireland in 2010. And we were friends. And then he was kind of like my fixer in Northern Ireland when I came back reporting, like, did I need a guy who had a car who could drive me to such and such? Do you know a great place for seafood on the North Coast? We stayed friends, and it kind of grew into more and more every time I visited.
Were you cohabitating? This is a very personal question, but I'm just curious.
When memoirists balk at personal questions, it's kind of an outrage. So go right ahead.
No, but I mean, like, where were you in your relationship when COVID happened? Like, were you living together? Were you married yet?
No, we weren't. No, we weren't. I mean, I think we were, you know, we had definitely grown very close. It was actually the spring before I moved over here. I moved over in autumn 2019. He came to New York for the first time.
Wow.
And we went to Oaxaca together for a week.
Wait, which bar did you take him to in New York? I gotta ask cocktail writer and drink
which
writer.
Which bars didn't I take him to in New York? I mean, he has this also connects with the Oaxaca trip. He loves Latin American spirits and food and drink. So, you know, we went to a lot of the old neighborhood bars and dives I love, like Milano's, like mm-hmm. South, where I used to work. But we also went to Leyenda. And I'm blanking on the name. It was a wonderful Oaxacan restaurant in Gowanus.
South was where you used to be a bartender.
South, yeah,
and
yeah,
it was
yeah.
South Slope, right? Because I used to live on the
Correct.
North Slope. So I was near
right.
like Gorilla Coffee and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But it was funny because we were just looking for apartments in New York, and we were in the South Slope. And I was like, wow. Like, if as somebody who lived in the North Slope, like, I'd never spent any time up there or down there, however you want to.
Worlds.
Yeah, but it's so cool over there. Do you miss New York?
You know, in some ways I do. And in most ways I don't. I really love where I live. I knew when I was coming over here, even if I wasn't sure what would come next, still thinking it would be a year. You know, I did give up my great deal of an apartment that I lived in for more than 20 years. And when I told people I was moving to Ireland, and I'd been, you know, sort of murmuring about it for a while, you know, their first question was never, you know, is there anything special you want to do in New York, you know, for, you know, we're going to miss you. The first question was always, who's getting your apartment?
Well, guess what? That's exactly the same thing here in LA. We have an apartment in LA that's two bedrooms in a great neighborhood that when we moved in, the neighborhood's called Atwater Village. And when we moved into this neighborhood 12 years ago, it was nothing. Like, it was still just sort of up and coming. And now these like buildings all around us, like these houses used to go for like 600,000 are now going for like 1.3 million. And we still pay the same rent that we paid back then. So people exactly the same thing where people are like,
exactly,
what are you doing with that apartment? So
that was my situation in Brooklyn. I had a great deal. I had great landlords. You know, I had been in the neighborhood while it changed and grew and in
Craig
good ways.
Calls that velvet handcuffs, like where it's like,
well, exactly. Yeah.
You can't leave. Yeah.
No. But anyway, Mark, my now husband, he had come to visit me in New York. We went to a lot of bars. We ate a lot of good food, but all of it was kind of overshadowed by how well we ate and drank in Oaxaca the next week. So, you know, I think that trip together, it was certainly the first time we traveled together. That made it clear that there was something meaningful.
Yeah, that's hard to do, to travel with somebody who you're newly in a relationship. Yeah, there's so many different ways that it could go.
It is. Yeah, someone who has a much higher tolerance for mezcal. We both love it, but he could drink me under the table there.
Really? I'm imagining like Indiana Jones, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, like you and him like throwing back shots one after the other.
You know, I think because I wrote about drink for such a long time, that's what people dreamed I would be like. But I was sort of a middleweight by that time in my life. Right. And now I'm really a lightweight, which is not what people expect when you've moved to Ireland.
I have so many questions about drinking, which I want to get to eventually.
So, you know, just to wrap up that that thread, you know, we were involved before I moved here, but still not sure how serious it was going to be. He was living in Belfast. And I knew leaving New York, I knew what I craved was countryside. And as much as I love Belfast and Dublin, the greatest portion of Ireland is the countryside and the shore. So yeah, then COVID came and, you know, we had a talk and he made the choice to move here to Glenarm and here we still are.
Glenarm. I mean, this sounds like I feel like it's like a postcard or a fairy tale or something. I'm
it's
very
all
jealous.
Those things, but yeah. Also totally a real place.
Yes.
You know, so.
Well, I could ask you a zillion questions from all of this, but I think the only question I should ask you is the question that forms the heart of this podcast, which is, Rosie, what did you have for lunch today?
Well, Adam, I had a whole plan. I made a little roast beef last night with Yorkshire pudding and I'm going to have some, just usually I graze at lunch, you know, I have a little bit of last night's dinner, a little bit of fruit, a little bit of this, a little. So I was looking forward to my roast beef leftovers. And then I discovered that my husband had not put the roast beef in the fridge overnight.
Oh, no. Fermented roast beef. They served that at Noma.
This is the thing. You know, will I drink milk past its sell-by if it smells and looks fine? Sure. You know, same with eggs. Same, you know, if it looks and smells fine. But I've been through too many food safety trainings for bar and restaurant work. And when I worked in homeless services to be like, nope. Meat that's been sitting on a counter for, you know, 8 hours, I'm not touching it. He seems to think it's fine. So say a little prayer for his gastrointestinal system.
Because did he eat it?
He intends to. So anyway, it made me completely change my plan. And I can't tell you this for a fact, but it's a pretty good bet that I'm the only person in Northern Ireland who had latkes for lunch.
Oh, interesting. Wait, I hope you don't mind my asking. I guess this is not like an offensive question because I'm Jewish and I'm asking if you're Jewish.
Yes.
Is that an offensive question? Like,
can a not Jewish person
be like, are you Jewish? I guess it's not, it's offensive that I think it's offensive. Now I'm like, really,
if you're offending yourself. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm not offended at all. and in fact, when I listened to your episode with Anya von Bremzen, that's when I learned you are Jewish. I hadn't known that before.
Really? Have you looked at my nose?
Yeah, but Robert, very goyish a surname.
Oh, but it was Rothenberg and it was changed.
Well, I didn't know. So
wait, you're Jewish and you live in Ireland, which is so funny because when you were talking about Ireland, I was going to say that for some reason in my Jewish upbringing, like Ireland was like never mentioned. It was not like a place that my parents were ever like, let's go to Ireland. Like it just was not on the radar. And it felt always to me like a very not Jewish place. And so I'm so fascinated to hear this.
Well, it is largely a very not Jewish place. and I joke that, you know, I call myself the Jewess of the Glens because I think I might be the only one, at least in the district where I live. And I think unlike a lot of Americans who move here, I have no Irish ancestry at all. I mean, what really brought me here when I was 20 was poetry. I was completely preoccupied with Yeats. Mm. But anyway, not a very Jewish place. And I thought it would be interesting to have latkes for lunch today and talk to you about it. because one thing I've noticed as an outsider, even though I feel very much like a part of my village, which has about 600 people, so it's small.
Oh my God. This sounds like a movie, like Waking Ned Divine or something.
If you know anyone who'd like the rights, I'm to discuss. Even though I feel like I'm part of this place, I still invariably feel like an outsider, of course, in many ways. And one thing I've noticed, I mean, my family's Jewish, but we were never religious.
Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard. And I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah. I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.
Whole Foods Market has savings to power your day during the Kickstart the Season event. Take advantage of a huge sale on all supplements, like vitamins, protein powders, probiotics, and more. There's a sale on all packaged coffee to get you back in the groove. Plus, find wallet-happy prices on breakfast like organic eggs and bacon from $3.65 by Whole Foods Market. And when the week gets busy, bring home a family meal and let the pros do the cooking. Kickstart fall at Whole Foods Market. Terms apply.
It was like Jewish foods I grew up with, you know, not even stuff my mom cooked because she didn't really make Jewish food. My grandma sometimes did. But, you know, if I wanted latkes, I'd get on the subway and go to the Second Avenue Deli.
Did you grow up in Manhattan?
Born and raised in Manhattan.
Where in Manhattan?
When I was a baby, Upper West, after that, Upper East, then Meatpacking District, when it was still the Meatpacking District, still carcasses on Gansevoort Street.
There's a lot to unpack about the Meatpacking District in our conversation.
Oh, there's a lot, but wow, I'm really glad I spent a couple of formative years there.
Well, it's funny because as you're talking about being Jewish in Ireland, I did think immediately of Ulysses, which I guess is like about sure. A Jewish person. So there you go. That's one thing.
Right. You know, if the most famous Jew in Irish literature, you know, it's an honor if I can somehow, you know, count the fictional Leopold Bloom among my allies here.
Right.
So I never made challah before I moved here. I never made latkes before I moved here. I was already pretty good at matzo ball soup, but I've gotten even better.
So wait, how do you make your latkes?
So I use my friend Dory Fern's absolutely foolproof award-winning recipe, which is so simple. You just, you know, grate an onion. Mm-hmm. Grate an onion into a bowl. Grate like three medium to large potatoes on top of the onion, salt and pepper, give it a little taste before you add the egg to see if it's salty and peppery enough.
Raw potato, that sounds kind of gross.
I mean, by that time it's been grated, you know, so yeah. It's just little, it's not so bad. I mean, it's okay. Not delicious yet, yeah. But it's not so bad.
You sound like a real Irish person talking about eating raw potato like that.
Oh, the potato jokes, we could go on all day. Anyway, so you grate the potato onto the onion, salt and pepper, give it a taste. And then Dory's brilliant move is that you squeeze out the liquid and put the drier stuff into another bowl and let the starch in the liquid settle. And then you work it back into the drier stuff. Well, first you add the egg to the shredded potato and onion. And then you add the starch back in. I got that wrong. The starch and then the egg. And then, you know, fry it in your choice of fat. I think her favorite is duck fat. Nobody's going to argue with that. So I happen to have a little bit of goose fat in the fridge today and some sunflower oil, and I used both.
Wow, to have goose fat in your fridge is pretty hardcore. I mean, I don't think I've ever had that.
Well, you know what? It's not as much of a luxury item here. Right. You know, it's a kind of regular supermarket thing here, which is funny because there's a lot of stuff that's hard to get here.
Really? What are some of the things that are hard to get?
Well, you know, for example, if I'm not, in a mood to make my own matzah, I order that from England.
Making your own matzah is so hard. I once did a recipe. I think it was Blue Ribbon. I feel like book. I don't remember which book it was, but I was like testing this recipe and I rolled it through like a pasta maker to make it really thin. But it said to do it on the bottom of your oven, like literally put it on the bottom of your oven. And like 5 minutes later, my kitchen was like on fire, basically. Like it smoked billowing.
I've seen that recipe or one similar. I used one that said a pizza stone was fine, but it's still a pain in the ass. So I ordered pizza. One thing that, you know, feels like a personal affront is that Chinese restaurants here don't normally have dumplings.
That's not good.
There's a real dumpling deficiency here, so I've had to, you know, there's a good big Asian supermarket in Belfast, and I try to get there like once every couple months and stock up on stuff. So out of necessity, you know, I've always loved to cook, but I've had to really learn a bunch of favorites just because they're not really available here.
Well, Rosie, it's funny because like my normal path in this podcast is to take your lunch and to analyze what it might mean about you. But I can't help but want to ask you about drinking, because I know you've written so many essays, books, columns about drinking. And it feels like right now in our culture, drinking is like sort of a big question mark subject, because a lot of people are going sober, or maybe, or for lack of, maybe it's not going sober, but just not drinking anymore. Mocktails are making a resurgence. And I feel like there's a time and a place for someone who enjoys drinking to make an argument for why it's actually good to drink. And I was wondering if, not to put you on the spot, but if that's something that you could talk about.
I can talk about it. I don't know if I have a great answer. I mean, I feel like I tried to sort of address that in my first book, Drinking with Men, which was a memoir about being a woman coming of age in bars. I've always loved bars. And I think part of my argument with that book was that it wasn't so much about the alcohol, although there was plenty of alcohol. It was really about bar life, about the cross-section of people who I met in bars I loved, who I never would have met anywhere else, you know, just a mix of people coming together because they happened to like this particular bar and felt at home there. Good World was one of those bars where you read. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, all of the things that I loved about drinking and part of bar culture, of course, does it make it easier to talk to strangers? Sure. Does it, you know, let you let your guard down in ways you wouldn't otherwise? Sure. Is it sometimes just delicious? Of course. although, you know, it's always interesting to me when people say, not wrongly, oh, you've written a lot about drink and blah, blah, blah. But I've never really thought of myself that way. I've thought of myself more as someone who writes about people. and drink is a sort of lens through which I got to write about and think about people. I just wrote, it was a real pleasure to write an introduction for a book coming out, I think, in September. It's a book of photographs by a New York photographer named Daniel Root, and it's called New York Bars at Dawn. And he did this really cool thing for years where, you know, pretty much at the crack of dawn, when most bar shutters are just about to come down, you know, when, you know, maybe the bartender or janitor is there sweeping, he looked through the windows of these bars, no special equipment, no special access, pressed his lens right up at the window and took these amazing photographs of, I mean, hundreds of New York bars of all kinds. And, you know, when I was writing that, he had first approached me about writing an intro when my life as a drinker was really changing. And I wrote briefly about this in the intro. I feel very lucky, Adam. I never had a bad breakup with drink. Just something happened to my metabolism,
right?
The way I live, where, you know, now maybe I'll have a few glasses of wine and a couple pints of Guinness a week. Maybe that's a busy drinking week for me now, you know, where back in my Good World days, it was probably three bottles of wine a night.
A night? Three bottles? No, okay, no, that's an exaggeration. I don't believe that.
Maybe two.
That's a lot. That's a lot to hold for one person.
In college, it was a lot of whiskey. So I never had this moment where I felt I had to stop. Just something in my constitution and body kind of slowed me down, which does feel really lucky because, of course, like everyone else, I've known people who had to have really painful breakups with drinking.
And I totally get that because, you know, I'm in my 40s and, you know, it's so interesting to me, like the role that drinking plays at different stages in your life, because for me, being gay, I was going to say when you talked about bars and going to bars, like for me, going to a gay bar was a transformative experience because I was like, I'm in a community of people. I am suddenly surrounded by like-minded people. But at the same time, it was also very intimidating because it was like a meat market. And, you know, I'd be like, you know, they're not looking at my brain right now. And so drinking could be a palliative, like to make that experience easier. And so I feel like drink can take on so many different meanings or different purposes. It could be a social lubricant. It could be a way to cope with fear. It could be something you just do for pleasure. And I feel like as I get older, I really do enjoy a cocktail. Like a lot of the places you've written about, you know, I was just looking at, I was doing my research and I was reading about like how you recommended like Ben Millman's bar way back when.
I would go have a drink there any day, of course.
Yeah. Or even like whatever the newer ones, we just went to, well, not newer, but like Clover Club in Boreham Hill, which is right near where we just got an apartment. Yeah. But, you know, I like the social aspect of it. But all of that said, I do feel it more as I get older. I feel when I drink, I wake up the next day, I'm like, oh, that was not worth it at all. So
no question. I mean, I just, you know, there was a time, you know, in my 20s, I could be out drinking all night and still wake up and go teach a class or write an article. Recovery time from a real session of drinking now, it's just not time I have anymore. It's just, I just can't.
Well, did you ever, I mean, I have to ask this because it's so like on the edge of like wondering about like, you know, addiction and people's real issues with drinking.
Yeah.
Like, did you ever like feel concern about that? Or, I mean, did you always feel in control of it?
No, I for myself?
Yes.
Oh, for myself. Yeah. I mean, I can answer this question two ways. For myself, of course. You know, at my most heavy drinking phase, which was certainly in my 20s, I mean, it was just a lot. And I wrote about this in Drinking with Men. I had a classic New York challenging roommate situation at the time. We had been good friends, but didn't get along so great once we were living together. And, she was an absolutely, unstoppable journal keeper. I mean, I think from the time she learned how to hold a pen, she always had a journal. And she would often leave it just open on our kitchen table as if, you know, and one day she had written that, you know, I was an alcoholic.
That's passive aggressive, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, I can give her the benefit of the doubt and say she didn't mean for me to read it, but of course she did. You know, but it did kind of give me a little nudge to, you know, to think about it and to slow down. And again, for me, it was so much tied to the culture of the bar where I was really spending a lot of time then. Drinking alone has never been interesting to me. I mean, you know, if you're drinking a great cocktail and there's no one there to enjoy it with, even if they're having a different cocktail and you're not having a good conversation, to me, a cocktail is pretty meaningless on its own, which is funny because food isn't to me. And I wonder what that's like. I'll cook myself a great meal, even if, you know, there's no one else to cook for. And that matters to me, where a drink, you know, maybe twice in my life I've been like, I need a martini or a margarita, and I've made myself one without any company. But for the most part, it was always part of the culture of the bar. And, you know, that's one reason, you know, in my long time as a bartender, I always wanted to make non-drinkers comfortable.
That's really interesting.
I didn't care if you weren't pouring a lot of money into the till of course, bar owners sometimes care about that. You know, I didn't care. I felt like, you know, if you're a good, interesting, nice person and want to hang out and enjoy what a bar gives us, aside from the alcohol, I want you to have a really good time too.
Well, it seems like the dialectic is about healthy drinking versus unhealthy drinking in terms of like, are you doing it for the right reasons, I guess, or are you doing mm-hmm. it in a way that is sustainable or not harmful? Mm-hmm. And so I wonder from the other perspective, when you were a bartender mm-hmm. and you were serving others, I'm mm-hmm. sure you saw like a whole spectrum of drinkers, from people who had a problem to those who were having their first night out. And so what was that like for you to encounter?
Sure. And that actually brings me to, I said there were two possible answers, you know, one about myself and one about, you know, how I take seriously what drinking can mean to other people. I mean, there was never, and you know, you talked about like what I saw as a bartender, and I certainly saw plenty, but I also saw so much as a regular. I really, really resent the kind of bartender who wants to get people shit-faced. I feel like that's not your job. I want people to have a good time and get home safely. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, I mean, I've had that, you know, I was about to say beneficiary. I don't know whether to say beneficiary or victim of an over-serving bartender. The drunkest night of my life, Adam, was just in your part of the world, in Inglewood.
Really? Yes. Where were you? What bar was it?
Well, man, could I tell you? I mean, this was like 1980-something.
Wow. I don't think I've ever been to Inglewood, so I don't even know.
Well, yeah. And back then, I mean, it's where the Forum is. Is it called Forum?
Yeah, yeah. I have been to the Forum. Yeah, I saw Louis C.K. there before he got canceled.
Before all that. Yeah. So I was there. I was just like a grimy teenage touring deadhead, and we went to Grateful Dead shows at the Forum, and we made pretty good money selling tie-dye t-shirts at them. So we thought we'd splurge on a motel room, and there happened to be a bar at the motel, and we went there, and that was honestly, this sounds like a joke, but it's I woke up once during the night. You know, I was sleeping under a desk. You know, there were like 20 deadheads packed into this one motel room. That's the way we were. So I woke up once, you know, realized I was under a desk, went back to sleep. Next time I woke up, I was in Santa Cruz.
And did you feel like you were safe, like protected by your fellow deadheads?
I was with a good group of people. I mean, you know, maybe they could have tried a little harder to see that I drank less than I had, maybe, but we were all kids, Adam. You know, we were underage. We shouldn't have been in a bar at all. I did feel I was in good hands, and I didn't remember a thing from the night before, and then it was narrated to me in gory detail.
So it was because you drank too much, not because you were roofied or anything.
No, not roofied.
It was just from drinking.
From a whole lot of Jack Daniels.
Well, it's so funny. So now we can go back to your psychology and your latkes, because one thing you mentioned earlier. Oh, wait, you want to finish something?
No, it's not that I want, you know, I love this idea of lunch therapy. But, you know, I feel like, you know, as you know, a Jewish New York woman who's been in a lot of therapy. Adam, are you a qualified psychotherapist?
I am an unlicensed lunch therapist. That's how I introduce myself every episode. So I am not qualified.
My mother would be concerned, but I feel safe with you.
Oh, good. Do you feel like this has been a healthy session so far? Do you feel
so
unburdened?
Far, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's funny because when you mentioned earlier, I'm trying to remember like what the, we talked about going to Ireland and how you were sort of rebellious and you went to Northern Ireland, even though you weren't supposed to. And I'm getting from your narrative overall this rebelliousness. And I don't know if the latkes fit into that at all, but this, you know, everything from being a deadhead to going to Northern Ireland to, you know, just the various things you're talking about. And I'm wondering how much of that has been a big part of your personality, or is that just a smaller part of the bigger picture?
Dr. Adam, you know, nothing would have thrilled me more at, you know, 20 when I made that trip I wasn't supposed to make to Belfast, or, you know, at 16 when I dropped out of high school. Nothing would have thrilled me more than being called a rebel. Mm-hmm. Now I wonder if I was just a big pain in my parents' ass. And I think it's somewhere between both. I mean, right. I don't know. I think I think that's certainly how I wanted to be perceived as a young person.
Right.
I think it's true that I did things that, you know, not every young person would have done. Looking back, I feel that most of my rebelliousness has been fairly safe. Grateful Dead tour appealed to me in large part because it felt like a ready-made way to see the country, to travel around with people.
Sidebar, have you ever watched the TV show Freaks and Geeks?
Of course.
Well, that's how it all ends. Do you remember? I mean, the spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it, but Lindsay Weir in the very last episode becomes a Deadhead and goes on tour with the Grateful Dead.
And that's how my high school life ended too.
Really? That's so cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely thought I was rebellious. I mean, these are small forms of rebellion, really.
Yes. Well, it makes me think that you weren't a rebel. You were a writer because you were hungry for experience, that you were just sort of like trying to soak in as much as you could. And even when you talked about drinking, and I liked what you said, that it's not about the drink, it's about the people, which also feels very writerly. It's like you want to be around people and soak in their stories and soak in their lives. So I think you're just a writer, not a rebel.
I'll take it, Adam. Thank you. I was going to say, for me, the real meaningful, interesting, not that all that stuff didn't mean anything. Of course, it helped me be whoever I turned out to be, but activism. As I said, I spent part of my growing up in the meatpacking district, and there's nothing in my life I think I'll ever be proud of than being a 14-year-old ACT UP foot soldier.
Wow, that's so cool.
While my neighbors were quickly getting sick and dying.
Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful that you did that. I mean, so strange for my generation to like look back on some of these movies that are coming out now or documentaries, mm-hmm. and to see that. And it's sort of, I feel like we are the beneficiaries of the work that you did and that a whole generation did.
And listen, I didn't do a lot of the work, but they needed bodies, and I knew that.
Yes.
And being one of those bodies was meaningful and a little scary. But, you know, as I said, the proudest thing I've ever, the thing I've been involved with that I've been more proud of than anything else, including various other activisms. But to look back, especially now in a time that can often feel so hopeless, mm-hmm. Not to bring the tone really low, and think, you know, people really did get loud and change the world and change the way things were done and made a huge difference.
Do you remember gay bars back? What was it like back then? I mean, I've seen the very, very sophisticated film Cruising starring Al Pacino. So I have some sense, but what was it like when you were 14 in New York in the meatpacking district?
Well, you know, on my walking route home from my school bus, you know, I mean, none of these places had big signs on the door,
right.
But I mean, you know, I lived very close to a place called the Mine Shaft, to these sort of legendary leather bars. And I had neighbors in our apartment building on Horatio Street who I knew were habitués. They were like the coolest sort of proxy uncles you could have. There weren't many kids in my building in the meatpacking district, so we were a bit of a novelty. So to have these, you know, wonderful men down the hall who would buy you vintage jewelry and your first little jar of Manic Panic hair dye.
Right. That's cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. I also had a mother who, for better or worse, was definitely sex positive.
Okay.
For better or worse, was extremely open about her own experiences experiences of others. So
that sounds very Jewish, because like my mom was an oversharer too when I was growing up, and I was like,
yeah,
I don't need to know that.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, a funny thing, you didn't grow up in the city.
I grew up on Long Island. And then when I was 11, we moved to Boca Raton, Florida.
Oh, stories for another day.
Yeah, that's what makes me drink the most.
I gotcha. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, growing up in New York, homophobia was so abstract to me because I was always surrounded by gay people, that it wasn't until I went on Grateful Dead tour that I saw how real and how damaging and pervasive it could be, even in a community that I think unfairly, maybe not prided itself, but thought of itself as egalitarian and open-minded. I saw a lot. But anyway, I mean, the gay bars, you know, it was things, you know, I knew that my cool neighbors went to these places with names like the Mineshaft and the Ramrod. I certainly knew about Stonewall. And in fact, when I was talking about Dan Root's book of New York bars at dawn, I love so many images in it, but the one of Stonewall just through the bar window is the one that sort of gets me most every time.
And it's an image of the people that are sitting there at the end
empty.
Of the night.
It's empty.
Oh, just bar empty bars. Empty. Right, it's when the bars are empty. Closed.
Right, okay. The lights are still on, but it's been swept, bar stool stacked. But you can kind of see the people who are there, even in this shot of it. You know, if you know anything about that place's history,
yes,
you know, you can just imagine how full of life and fight and everything it was. So, you know, I mean, my first bar that I went to underage was a real meatpacker's joint, an Irish bar, the Eagle Tavern on 14th Street. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, we were literally around the corner. Florent, from Florent.
Oh, right. And I went there right before it closed. So
yeah.
That's so a really cool place. Yeah.
These weren't exactly explicitly gay bars, but there were always, always plenty of gay eaters and drinkers in them. And it was
Florent was a restaurant. And I remember reading about it, maybe in the New Yorker, because the owner, Florent, was HIV positive. And I think like he had like a board in the front every day where he would put his white blood cell count, like to say like where, you know, what he was, how healthy what he was that day. Well, it's funny you mentioned that book of photography, because my favorite LA gay bar, which is also just our favorite LA bar, is called ACK Bar. And it's really like the Cheers of gay LA. It's like where we go and we see friends and we see enemies and we see, you know, you see everyone. But the bouncer, this guy Bill, who we're friends with, has a secret Instagram that I'm sort of outing right now, and he calls it Mail Slot Boys. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the night at 2 a.m. when the bar closes, he pushes the mail slot open and takes a picture of the guys on the street sort of like flirting with each other.
So he's photographing outside.
Yes. Of like what's going on. And every time he does that, I'm like, I know that person. You know, it's really kind of fun. But yeah, that place is so special for us because it really does feel like a home away from home. And it speaks to like the idea of community. And now in New York, it's sort of Julius. I don't know if that was around.
Well, Julius, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's taking on a whole new life now. You know, John Cameron Mitchell, the filmmaker, has an event there called the Mattachine Society, which is a reference to the one from LA. And so it's really cool to see how culture and bars and communities and all kinds of stuff kind of overlap.
Yeah, it's great. And it sounds to me like Akbar, you don't feel the kind of intimidation, meat markety. Hey, you're a married person.
Yeah, but I'm a nerd, and it's filled with nerds. So it's kind of like the gay nerd bar. But I was going to ask you, I mean, and we're almost running out of time, which is crazy because I feel like we just started. But I was doing my research, my due diligence, even though I'm not a journalist or a licensed lunch therapist. And you mentioned your parents and your father was a famous writer, a sports writer. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about him.
Yeah, sure. My father was a wonderful writer. you know, I think there are, I have a lot of respect for sports writing. So I don't want to make this sound like I'm belittling the profession generally, but I think he's regarded as a kind of thinking man's thinking person, sports writer. Mm-hmm. And just as I said, you know, it's not drink that interests me as a writer, it's people. He felt exactly the same way about sport.
And his name is Dick Schaap, right? For people who want to look up his stuff. Schaap.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a great writer. He wrote, I think, 40 books. You know, most of them followed a formula. And I'm not saying that dismissively, just his sort of MO was to interview and then transcribe those tapes and really, you know, fashion a book out of those transcripts. And I often earned my allowance as a kid transcribing those tapes.
That's fine.
So I never went to journalism school, but I felt like I had this kind of accidental journalism boot camp from working with my father. We had a tough relationship. You know, my parents split up since I'm in therapy, Adam.
You can lay down if you want to. It's totally optional.
My parents split up when I was 7. They had a very heated, uncooperative, awful divorce. So my father wasn't in my life a lot for a long stretch of my childhood. You know, we had largely, I think, reconciled by the time he died, which was young. He had a hip replacement surgery, and then this was really just a few months after 9/11. So the two events are always kind of twisted and conflicted in my mind. Gone in for a hip replacement surgery, which wasn't quite as routine and easy as they seem to be now. And he wound up with acute respiratory distress syndrome. And lived 3 months, not exactly in a coma, but something similar to a coma. So I felt we had more or less mended fences when he died. But he was hugely influential. I mean, as a reader, he was a fantastic reader. He took people in everyday life so seriously. I mean, this is a slightly food related story. After he died, he had a great, great big memorial service at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. They let Jews have memorials there, just so you know.
Okay, good to know. I'll put in a request.
And I had been working in anti-poverty nonprofits at the time, and one of my colleagues was way back somewhere. I was up front with a family, and she wrote to me afterwards and said, I have to tell you this story, that I wound up sitting next to this wonderful man who had been a peanut vendor at Shea Stadium. And my dad had met him many times. At Shea Stadium, my father was often at every ball game imaginable. And he told my friend, he said, you know, almost no one who bought peanuts from me asked me what my name was. And Dick did, and he always remembered it and always looked for me. And that's why I'm here at his memorial service.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I mean, that's something I will always really love about my father. In everyday interactions, he treated people really genuinely, decently. And took people seriously.
And it sounds like you got that from him a bit. I'm just thinking of you as a bartender and the way you took care of your customers.
He would have been an amazing bartender.
Yeah. But I'm also thinking about writing because, you know, you said he was you grew up with him as a writer, and obviously you're a writer. And I'm wondering, was there anything that you learned from his approach to writing, or was there anything about his approach to writing that informed your own approach to writing?
Well, sure. I mean, first I rebelled against it. The first kind of writer I dreamed about being, Adam, was a poet. Mm-hmm. And then I learned you had to be very, very good to really make a dent. And that, you know, even compared to other kinds of writing, it's a pretty hard way to make a living. I still read poetry.
Yeah.
Were you a poet too?
No. I'm just thinking about, like, I know people who are poets, and just a lot of them luckily come from like generational wealth or something where they don't rely on it to make their living. Yeah.
I mean, listen, my dad made a good living, but I wouldn't call it generational wealth. So that wasn't. So I kind of backed into writing. You know, I had started a PhD in my 20s that I didn't finish. And like a lot of PhD English dropouts, I wound up working in publishing And then I thought I wasn't doing enough in the world. So I went to work at the anti-poverty nonprofits I mentioned. And after a few years of that, I went crawling back into publishing and teaching, and still kind of resisting this I'm a writer idea, you know, and certainly journalism, because that's mostly what my dad did. I'm not going to be a journalist. And just kind of stepped backwards into it. And it, you know, it turned out I was better at it than the other things I'd tried. So I stuck with it.
And with journalism, I mean, you talked about transcribing your dad's interviews. So did you take the same approach? Did you record all your interviews and then transcribe them? Or how did you do it?
Well, I mean, you know, the sort of deepest profiles I've done of people, my second book came out in 2019, and it was called Becoming a Sommelier. And it was,
yes, which I want to ask you about too. Oh my God.
I'm not a sommelier, but it was part of a wonderful series that Simon & Schuster put out. And you know, I don't know if it was my instincts, but I just chose the best people to profile. The amazing Roger DeGorn, who had been the legendary sommelier at Chanterelle back in the day and a million mm-hmm. other places. And Amanda Smeltz, much younger at that time, the beverage director at Estella.
We just went there. I literally just had dinner there. It's really good.
Yeah. The food is really good. And they're just both so different. And so, I mean, that was exactly my dad's style. I did exactly for that book, because it wasn't a book about me. I mean, I come up in the intro and, you know, here and there, I pop my head in. But it was so much about them, and they're both so interesting, and they were both so generous with their time that, you know, I transcribed the interviews and really, did exactly what my father had done. And so the book.
Go ahead, finish. Yeah.
The book that's coming out next year, which has to do with drinking only incidentally. It's a lot about grief and why I live in Ireland now, and the village where I live. And a lot of it is memoir, but there's also a social history component for which I did a lot of interviews in the village. And that was the same kind of idea. Just let people speak for themselves.
That's really, it takes, you know, it's funny. My husband's working on a documentary right now about the band, the B-52s, you know.
No kidding. I love the B-52s.
And I was watching a little clip from it. And I was like, I told him I liked what I saw so far, because he really stepped back and like let the story tell itself. And I think that's really, I think when you're a young writer or a young director or a young whatever, your instinct is to put as much of yourself in something as you can. And as I get older, I'm like, it's not, you know, tell the story. It's about the story. It's not about you. And it's, you know, it takes some training to get to that point. So,
I've been teaching nonfiction writing for years. And one of the things I always tell students is, if you have a chance to ghostwrite, do some ghostwriting. You know, it's nothing makes it clearer that this isn't always about us.
Right.
Especially nonfiction writers who are always writing memoir and personal essays. I find myself exhausting sometimes. So it's great to get to focus on someone else.
I was going to ask, so you, earlier you said that you moved away from cocktails, and now you're, I remember you said Guinness, and was it wine? Sure. Wine that you still drink?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, my little village has two pubs, and the one that's my local, I know, you know, many, many disagreeing listeners might be in a rage. It really has the most delicious Guinness at a great price. And I love it. But, you know, where in my 20s, when I was studying in Dublin, I drank 7 pints in a go. I mean, 2 pints of Guinness is a good night out for me now.
And then wine from the sommelier book. I mean, did you take on like an interest in wine after working on that?
I mean, listen, you know, and I think I mentioned this in the book, I'll be honest, even though I got that amazing, you know, unbelievable, I couldn't even imagine such a thing existed job, you know, writing about drink for the Times Magazine, I always liked wine more than cocktails. Wine had been part of my life much longer, always something I've drunk more of. So, you know, wine has always been something I loved. And I did learn a lot listening to Amanda and Roger. And I do think, you know, largely thanks to Amanda, I think so much more about where my wine is coming from. You know, the way I'd been thinking about my food for so long, I hadn't been thinking about wine and other drinks that way. And Amanda really really shifted my thinking.
Ireland have wine? Like, do they make wine? I guess is a better
Nobody's
way to ask.
Making wine in Ireland. I don't know much about winemaking here. You know, what's been a little harder, you know, really looking for the wines I started loving more when I was, you know, writing about Amanda, you know, looking for natural wines, looking for wines from small producers. That's a little trickier here. I did find in a village about an hour drive from here, there's an all organic wine shop where you can also take Irish language classes, which is pretty amazing.
That's cool. Wow. I want to come visit you now that you've invited me yet.
Yeah. I'm in one of our two guest rooms right now.
Oh my God. Well, I really will take you up on that. And one final drinking question, and then we'll get to my last question. From all your years as a bartender and we're writing about, you know, cocktails and stuff, is there a cocktail that is your like measure of a great bartender? Like when you go to a bar and order a cocktail, is there something that you'll order to see how good a bar it is?
I think the old fashioned.
An old fashioned. And what?
Old fashioned, an absolute classic, arguably the oldest cocktail, at least oldest recorded. I should know that for fact. I don't, but you can fact check with David Wondrick and he'll tell you. Anyway, if not the oldest recorded cocktail, one of them. And I just think it is a drink that, you know, people exaggerate all kinds of things when we talk about drink and food, but I think in drink it becomes almost sort of bizarrely, abstractly metaphysical. I think there is a kind of balance that is struck in a delicious old fashioned that you know it when you taste it. And if the drink doesn't quite have that just you know, little sort of shot of sweetness in it, a nice taste of whiskey or rum or whatever you're making your old fashioned with, coming through, just that little bit of bitters. And I know this sounds super corny to most people, but I think you'll be with me here, Adam. With food and drink, I think you can always taste the love and care that go into whatever you're eating or drinking.
And an old fashioned is made by muddling a sugar cube, or is that you put a sugar cube in a glass and you soak it in bitters? Is that what you do first?
A little bit of bitters. And then, yeah. I mean, it's really just that, and ice and whatever the spirit is.
So it's really about the approach and the technique.
Really elemental. Then, you know, you might have a little, you know, rub a little orange peel with or without a little more bitters around the rim. You know, there's also the kind of, I guess, more like 50s, 60s style where you'd actually pound the maraschino cherry and the orange. Ah. A lot of cocktail snobs look down on that, but it can be delicious too.
That sounds good. My other question is about the preponderance of the Negroni in recent years, because now it's
aren't we
everywhere.
Over that already?
Yeah. Have you? What was your first encounter with the Negroni trend, and do you feel like it's a worthy cocktail that deserves its stature?
I do think it's worthy. Although I like the spagliato more, you know, the botched Negroni where you replace the gin with some, you know, sparkling Italian wine. Mm-hmm. Listen, I like Campari. You know, I feel like if you don't like Campari, then there's no reason to go near a Negroni. You know, to me, it's not too controversial. If, you know, I mean, even though it's equal parts of each ingredient, it's never, you know, the Campari is such an assertive flavor. Mm-hmm. It's always going to taste like Campari. But, you know, so I don't know. I mean, it did seem to really reach this crazy.
Well, it's everywhere. You know, I mean, I was just in New York and there are restaurant menus that literally have Negroni, different kind, like Negroni menus. I mean, I was just at this place.
I thought it may have been supplanted by the Aperol Spritz or something.
No,
like that.
No. There's like, now there's like white Negronis, yellow Negroni.
I mean, I mean, for me, the main thing about the Negroni, again, goes back to people. When I think of a Negroni, I think about Gary Regan. I don't know if you knew Gary Gaz. No. He was a wonderful drink writer, a wonderful character, a very generous figure in the world of drink and drink writing. And he was famous for this thing he called the finger-stirred Negroni.
Okay.
So the adaptation there was that you were having a Negroni in which Gary Regan had plonked his finger and stirred.
You know, as a little extra flavor, a little
I guess
umami.
So, but yeah. He was a great Negroni advocate, and he assembled an anthology about the cocktail with essays about the drink, and I have a little essay in there. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man who is.
I'm going to look for that. That sounds great. Well, Rosie, you've been so generous with your time. Every podcast begins with what did you have for lunch? And it ends with what will you be having for dinner tonight?
You know, I don't know yet. I don't know yet. My husband works late tonight. So neither of us is here to make a fuss about feeding both of us. I think he doesn't love pasta, Adam. So I know.
That's an issue. I don't know about that.
He likes pasta. He'll eat anything. But I don't know. I'm kind of feeling it for, you know, one of my very simple go-tos, which is telefono, where you just have the pasta and crushed tomatoes. Listen, I don't know whether to say tomato or tomato anymore.
The tomato was very fancy.
Yeah. and I have a lot of nice, fresh, basil. My brain doesn't know which way to go anymore.
But whatever's natural.
Super simple pasta with some nice mozzarella, nice tomato, call the whole thing off, and basil, as you wish.
And will he have the fermented roast beef too?
If he survives it, I'm a little worried. He will probably have the fermented. He doesn't, you know, Irish folks, they don't like to see a thing go to waste.
Right.
And I will tell you, I've learned an Irish mother is a lot like a Jewish mother in my life.
Good note to end on. That sounds like another therapy session waiting to happen. So, Rosie, thanks for being so open and talking about all these, answering all my nervy questions. I hope you feel properly therapized.
No, Adam, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me to lunch therapy. It's been fun.
Of course. Well, I hope to see you either in New York or Northern Ireland or somewhere soon.
All right, Come on over.
All right, have a good night. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Adam. Bye.
Bye. All right, that's it for this week's session. If you'd like to follow along with my cooking adventures and my move to New York City, give me a follow on Instagram and Twitter at Amateur Gourmet, and subscribe to my newsletter, amateurgourmet.substack.com. All right, I'll see you back here next week, and don't forget to eat lunch.